Okay, you need a test. Testing 1, 2, 3. 3.14159265355789. That's as far as I can go.
What about the resolution of pi?
Resolution of pi? Well. Okay, that's good. Well, I can kind of empathize with you, Ross. I just got back very late last night after an 8-day trip to Western Pennsylvania. So the first part of the trip, I was sponsored by a radio station in downtown Pittsburgh, Word FM, and did a weekend. That's where I was last Sunday, Saturday and Sunday and Monday, there in basically at the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon. When you go into downtown Pittsburgh, they got these two large universities that are literally just a few blocks apart. And there's a Presbyterian church squeezed right in between them. And so we had the events there. And what I appreciated about the church, they basically told their people, don't come. We want to make sure there's room for the students and the faculty. And we did have a lot of students and faculty. A lot of science faculty showed up. Found out that there were a lot of believers on the science faculty of both Carnegie Mellon and University of Pittsburgh. And I had the experience I've had before where a professor would come up to me and say, you know what, I'm the only evangelical Christian science professor on the campus. And I say, well, you can't be. You need to introduce yourself to this gentleman over here. He told me the same thing. So, and there's actually quite a large number of them. So it's just fun making the connection so they can all meet one another. That's one of the blessings of the kind of stuff I do, is just getting these people connected. So that was fun. And I think what, you know, we celebrated the 25th anniversary of Reasons to Believe Thursday before last. And having been around for 25 years, I think it was a special blessing on this particular trip. I was in Titusville, I was in Grove City, and in Pittsburgh. In every single case, we got to see the next generation. Many students came up to me and said, you know, my mother and my father found out about your ministry 20-some-odd years ago. They read their books. They got me excited about them. Now I'm a fan of the Reasons to Believe ministry as well. So it is being passed on to the next generation. In fact, there is a Bible study I used to teach here in Sierra Madre, 32 years ago. A guy by the name of Jerry Wombolt opened up his home because he wanted all these unbelievers to come in and hear the gospel message. Well, I went, ran into his son at one of these universities, and he says, yes, my dad faithfully passed on the ministry of Reasons to Believe to all of us kids, and I'm here at Grove City College. And Grove City College, unlike the University of Pittsburgh, is a Christian institution, and I was there 9 years ago, and just coming back and seeing how much larger the campus is. And it's a Christian campus that's dedicated to preparing their young people to be effective in outreach. They're sending them out to all kinds of different secular careers, and they have very high academic standards. Most of their students go on to get master's and PhDs at different institutions, places like Harvard and MIT, Berkeley. But they want to make sure they're prepared to share their faith At that high academic level. And so I found out that the professors there have been using our textbooks, well, our books, but they use them as textbooks. And I've had several meetings with the science faculty there. They actually have every science department represented. Even though they only have 2,500 students, they got five professors in the physics department, same number in the chemistry department, the biology department, computer science department, and they have three different disciplines of engineering represented. So it's quite different from your typical Christian university, which tends to be all liberal arts. This place does have the liberal arts. Oh, and you'll probably be interested, two of the students that used to attend regularly here are at Grove City College. The Phillips daughters, both of them are there. Lynn's a senior, and her sister Chris is, I think, a sophomore there now. They're both doing well. Lynn has already got three papers published in the peer-reviewed literature as a senior undergraduate, so she's well on her way. She'll be with us here at Easter time, so maybe she can tell you more about what's happening there. But I found out the professors are very impressed with her academic performance, and She is going to be going on to get a doctorate, so we probably won't see her around for quite a while. But it was interesting because she set me up to meet with several student groups while I was there, and she just kept saying, you know, it's so different hearing you here on the campus and hearing you in the Sunday school class. And she kept telling all the other students, yeah, what he does is he takes 9 months of the Sunday school class and squishes it down into 1 hour lecture. So so she told all the students, when you come, bring your notebook. She says, you gotta be paying attention every bit of the way. So, but that's one of the luxuries of doing this class, is I can kind of slow the material down. And the other thing she says, I think what makes a difference is that when I'm lecturing on a campus like that, I don't take interruptions. I just go straight through, and then we have a Q&A afterwards. But there is, I really enjoy this class, by the way, because I can be stopped at any time, and we'll take discussions, we'll take segues and tangents. And that's something I don't get to do when I'm doing my typical public speaking. And so Lynn really understood why you need to have both, and we need to be exposed to both. But she says, you know, it's really interesting. Most Christians either hear one style or the other. They don't get both. And she says, frankly, this is my first time to get both. So they have younger students. That's one thing I noticed. I was there 9 years ago, and 9 years ago, the student body, I would say, was predominantly young earth. This time, it's in a minority, in a very small minority. And the younger students that did come and ask questions, they weren't hostile. Basically, they're saying, look, this is what I've been taught. This is what I've been exposed to. You have to explain to me where you're coming from and why. And also, they're very interested because I got to give my personal testimony there. And, one of them was saying, well, when did you find out about the young earth view? And I said, well, I found out about it 10 years after I became a Christian. And that kind of shocked them. You mean you went 10 years and never even heard of this view? And I said, no, not until I gave a lecture in San Diego. And then I really heard about it. So, and so that was intriguing to them, that here I was with no contact with Christians or church reading the Bible, and how there was not even an inkling that this could be, from my perspective, a young earth book. Just kind of explaining, well, you know, you go through Genesis 1, there's no evening, morning for the seventh day. It's a day when God's at rest. You look at the record of nature, God is clearly resting from his miraculous work of intervention today, but was active in the past. I said, that just makes the science, just makes so much good sense of the science, with God creating for 6 days and resting on a long seventh day. And then you notice in Genesis 1, you got both the human male and the human female made on day 6. But you look at Genesis 2, a lot goes on between the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve. And you got Adam saying things in the process like, I'm lonely. And at long last, when he sees Eve, and I said, you know, a man doesn't behave that way in 10 minutes at the end of a 24-hour day. So,
one girl in my Bible study said 24 hours is a long time for a male.
She may be thinking about certain men, but but what I notice is no hostility, and moreover, those who were asking questions about the young earth view very easily came around. And I think one reason why they so easily came around is that they trust their science faculty. Their science faculty are all old earth. And I had several dinner meetings with the science faculty. And I think one thing that Grove City is trying to deal with is this growing trend within the Christian education system to develop a minimalist view of Revelation. And what I mean by that is where you have the Bible saying as little as possible about the record of nature, and you got the record of nature saying as little as possible about theological issues, and that's a way to avoid any conflict between what nature says and what the Bible says. And to a man and a woman, all of them said, you know, we just find that unacceptable to take that kind of a minimalist view. When you actually read the Bible, it's not taking a minimalist approach. And moreover, we're scientists. Why would you take a minimalist approach to science? You know, both science and theology should have the freedom to address whatever issues And if there's overlap, so be it. Let's deal with it. But their whole point was we're seeing a growing, what they called, a lack of courage within the Christian education system to actually wrestle with these issues and try to bring some resolution. And it was thrilling just for us to see what great fans all these science professors at Grove City are. So at least we got one Christian campus that really seems to be solidly supportive of what we're doing. Maybe the only one, I don't know. But at least we got one that's there. So, Biola, pretty much. But again, there's other issues with Biola that I won't talk about. So, but we at least get to speak there once in a while, but usually in a classroom, not in a public setting. And the reason they don't want us in a public setting is we offend the young earth crowd. We don't purposely offend the young earth crowd. We offend them because, you know, we're not backing down on saying that the universe is about 14 billion years old and the earth is 5.6, whereas most of the faculty of Biola will say, we don't know. And, you know, I tell people, I'm an astronomer. There's no way that I can maintain integrity and tell an audience I don't know how old the earth is or the universe is. That's like saying I don't know whether the world is flat or round. I mean, and moreover, I don't think this is at all a controversial issue. If you just simply stick to the straight, you know, let's read the biblical text, let's see what the record of nature's got to say. But as I've told you before, I think the real issue in the church is they don't want these cantankerous scientists getting involved in their churches. And so they found a doctrine that pretty well guarantees that that's not going to happen. So, in fact, what I told the scientists there at Grove City and also the University of Pittsburgh, the Christian ones, if you want to see this young earth issue go away, you scientists have to get involved in the life of the church. A lot of scientists do go to church, but they're like wallflowers. Wallflowers, pardon me. In fact, I can tell you this. Our nation's most famous astronomer at the time was a regular attender of this church, but he never said a word. He just sat in the very back of the balcony and wouldn't engage, wouldn't talk to people. And, you know, there's a lot of scientists that are like that.
But
that was Alan Sandage. So his kids attend here, and they're active in the church. But Alan himself, and, you know, he just didn't want to rock the boat. And he was worried that the culture here wouldn't really accept him. And I said, well, that's the case with the Gentiles in the first century. Jews didn't want them attending church either. But once the Gentiles got to be the majority within the church, the circumcision issue completely evaporated. It was gone, just like that. Likewise, I think the young earth issue will disappear just like that once we get significant participation on the part of engineers and scientists. I say that because if you read church history, for the past 2,000 years, the church has consistently split and fought over the non-essentials of the Christian faith with the goal of keeping certain undesirables out of the church. And that's why Jesus came, is to bring these disparate peoples together. You know, Paul talked about the mystery of the gospel, where because of the gospel message, you can have Jews and Samaritans and Gentiles all fellowshipping together and loving one another. But, you know, it's always a challenge to get people to love one another. It's a challenge wherever you go in the world to get people to love one another. But I can tell you, the very first day I came to this church, you know what impressed me? I saw a man in a three business suit holding a hymnal with a guy with bare feet and a dirty T-shirt and a long, scruffy beard. And I said, the only thing that can be keeping these two men together is the Spirit of Jesus Christ. This is the place where I want to fellowship. So they'll know that you're Christians because of your love for one another. But that's been a consistent problem with the church. And I got to see that forcefully. I'll take your question in a minute. One of the more dramatic events at the University of Pittsburgh is that you know, I gave this lecture and we had a Q&A time. We told the students and faculty the Q&A time is going to last at least 2 hours, 3 hours if you're willing to keep going. Well, this one guy heard about that and he really wasn't there for the lecture. He missed my lecture, but he was there at the beginning of the Q&A time, was right at the front, and he spent, about 5 to 8 minutes just yelling and screaming how horrible Christians are, that they're tightwads, they're misers, they don't care about people, they don't give, And, you know, they just mistreat everybody. And I said, well, is there a question here? And he just kept going on and on. And he said, no, I want you to respond to this. And I says, well, first of all, the IRS keeps very good statistics on charitable giving. And, you know, in terms of who gives the most to their church, Seventh-day Adventists are at the top. They give about 7% of their total income to their church. But I said, they're not at the top of the list. At the very top of the list are Christians who attend non-denominational churches, and they give around 13 to 14% of their total income. But it doesn't all go to their church. They spread their charity around. And that actually helped mollify them. Because his whole idea is, yeah, they give, but they only give to themselves or their church. And I says, well, if you actually look at the IRS statistics, you see something very different. That it's not just the church, it's to quite a broad spectrum of organizations. And then he said, well, what about the Catholics? And I said, well, you know, they're down around 1.5% to 1.7%. So, but keep in mind, most Catholics are not serious about their Catholicism. You know, you can be a Catholic in good standing if you go to church twice a year. So, and then says, guess who's on the very bottom? And I didn't have to say anything. Everybody in the audience says, atheist. So, I'm just saying, you know, that you can look at the IRS records. It's all public domain. You can see for yourself where the charity lies. And because he was saying, you know, none of this is true. And he says, well, go on the web and check it out for yourself. This is not something I'm just pulling off the top of my hat. This is IRS statistics, and you can check it all out. But his real issue was, he was obviously, because he was just spewing with anger. I said, well, let me just ask you a question. It seems to me that you've really run into some people who call themselves Christians who are very abusive towards you. And boy, he just really let out. He says, you're telling me. He said a few other choice words that I won't repeat. And then we talked about, well, is it really rational to let a human being get between you and having a relationship with the one that created the universe and of all life? And he began to melt. And we just kept on for about another 10 minutes because, you know, what was happening, the person controlling the microphone kept taking away. He says, no, let's let this conversation go. There's something productive going on here. So, but I think it really set a good tone for the rest of the Q&A discussion because people were realizing, okay, there's more at stake than just getting answers intellectually. We have to deal with the personal issues. And yes, lots of people call themselves Christians who really aren't Christians. And even those who really are Christians, you know, we're not perfect. We're sinners, we're offensive, we're obnoxious. But the real measure is, and this is what I had a chance to share with them, is that if you run into someone who's truly given their life to Jesus Christ, yes, they'll be obnoxious, but as you get to know them, they become less and less obnoxious as time goes on. Look at the trend line. Don't look at where they are. Look at the direction they're moving. And they're moving in the right direction. That should be positive. And that's what God's promising to you. You can become progressively less obnoxious with respect to them. And one guy said, amen. Sometimes people should just keep their mouth shut. But anyway, you had a comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, this thing that's dividing the big division between old earth and young earth among Protestants. And I used to be a Catholic, but I never entered my head as to whether Catholics believe, are they old earth or young earth? Do they believe literally, or I'm not sure.
Well, official Roman Catholic position is old earth, but they're also tending to go along with Darwinian evolution. Although what was interesting is when I was in Titusville, I was sponsored jointly by a Baptist church and a Roman Catholic diocese. And I thought, this is really interesting. We've got Baptists and Catholics working together for an event. And I actually had an opportunity to have breakfast with all these Catholic priests. And what I found out is when you get into the rural parts of the country, the Roman Catholic priests tend to be much more conservative. And these were all fans of the new Pope and asked me if I'd read his papers on science and faith. And I said I had. And he said, well, that's what we notice, is that the Protestants are aware of what the Pope is writing, but the Roman Catholics aren't. So, but what really impressed me, every one of these priests was really working hard at getting their parishioners into personal Bible study. And they said, you know, it's the most important thing we can do for our flock is get them into the Bible, get them reading it for themselves, and getting them discussing and dialoguing and debating it over within them with themselves. And I really felt a good sense of fellowship with these men. I mean, they just seemed to be really, and they believed in salvation by grace, not by works. So, I mean, they seemed to have that solidly under their belt. And they were also very eager in partnering with Protestants in turn dealing with the pro-life issue and other moral issues. So, and the Baptists felt the same way. He said, you know, if, you know, we have more in common, he says, with these Roman Catholic priests than we do with the Presbyterians down the street, the Methodists down the street. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So that was a really special experience for me just to see that going on there. But yeah, you had another comment. Or not?
No.
No, okay. Okay, sorry. All right. Well, to me, the real highlight was coming home on the plane last night. It was a long flight between Pittsburgh and Phoenix. And there was this guy on the plane who pulled out his laptop. I've got a 17-inch laptop here. He had a 19-inch laptop. 19-inch laptop. No. Well, I later found out that this guy should have been in first class. But anyway, I was just asking him questions about his computer. And he says, oh, this is custom design. I wanted 19 inches, so we cut it. You know, it's all different components he put together. He says, I like to have a really big laptop. And he looked at mine and says, I noticed you don't have a glossy screen. Why don't you have a glossy screen? And I said, well, I'm a public speaker. And, you know, if it's glossy and you're moving around like this, you can't always see what's on there. And I want to be able to, you know, keep good eye contact with the audience and be able to see what's on the screen. And he said, what do you speak on? And then when I told him, we went on for another 2.5 hours. So what was interesting about this guy is that he has a bachelor's in physics and completed his first year of his master's degree, and then he got a business idea through an invention of his. Well, bottom line was that was the end of his education. He launched this business, and now he has a business in a part of West Virginia, but he has 50 PhD scientists that work for him, and they just invent things. But he says, we also manufacture what we invent. So we figure that's the most profitable way to go. Don't just do the inventing, actually produce the product. So he opened up his computer and showed all the buildings that he has at his headquarters and how much he enjoys just talking to the scientists. And he heard about our scientific team. He said, boy, I'd sure love to talk to you guys. Anyway, he gave me his business card and wants to sign up for our all of our stuff and wants to actually come into town sometime, spend time with our scientific team. And he says, I've always realized I needed to get, you know, really think seriously about this God science stuff, but I've been too busy. And he's about his mid-40s. But he says, you know, just meeting you tells me I need to start taking this seriously. He says, I do believe in God, but I really need to take it to the next level. And it sounds like your organization just what I need to get there. So, I got his card in my briefcase. I can dig it out and get you his name. But the other thing is, he says, you know, I got all this money. I don't know what to do with it. So, and then he said, but actually, what I think I knew doing what to do with it. He says, we have 4 universities in West Virginia. All but one of them have shut down their Department of Physics. I think I'm going to use my money to relaunch a Department of Physics in these other institutions. So, and so if I give them enough money, they're going to have to do something. So, been a very interesting fellow to talk to, and very open. So, it's not an accident who you get to sit beside on an airplane. So, I mean, it's kind of, and by the way, what was really fun, too, is we got into the conversation. There were actually people standing in the aisle listening to our conversation. So, yeah.
Do you have any comments yet? I know it's a little early on the, I believe, copper plates that have been found codices that have been found that look like they may be between the period of the resurrection and but before Paul's left.
Well, I actually did see that because one of the hotels I was staying in had free internet. I'm a Scot, so I don't pay for the internet. But if it's free, I'll use it. But I did catch that announcement. And from what I can tell, it's a little too soon to say yay or nay on the authenticity. So it's being checked. And I didn't see too much data coming out as to exactly what it contains in terms of content. The real interest now is trying to establish a date for it and whether or not this is an authentic artifact. And, you know, you do have to be careful because there's been lots of hoaxes that have been exposed in the last 3 years. And it's because these kinds of artifacts draw such a very high price. I mean, if they're genuine, this is millions of dollars, whoever owns it. But consequently, there are a lot of people in the Middle East who will, you know, fake it, like that guy who claimed to have the box with the bones of Jesus in it. And it turned out to be a fake. Then he claimed to have the bones of Jesus' brother. That turned out to be a fake. So wait and see.
Well, the James ossuary, I think, has generally, it's just survived a year of testimony. And the Israeli Archaeological Authority, their case against it has fallen apart. But from what I know of the James ossuary, there seems to be more proof for it.
There's this building, but it's not at a point yet where everybody's saying this is like the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's what I saw in the announcement, that these copper foils would be just like the Dead Sea Scrolls. But we're not there yet.
Where were they found?
Found very close to where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, yeah, which is what made some of the archaeologists suspicious. Okay, this is from a place near the Dead Sea Scrolls. That place has been searched very thoroughly. Why hasn't anybody found it until now? And so a little bit worried that this is another Bedouin hoax. So that's why there's kind of a wait and see on this. Yeah.
Are they very small pieces or are they like...
Oh, they're small.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about credit card size is what they're saying. So they're thinking this is a personal codex rather than something that, say, a church or a synagogue would have owned. This would have been something a private individual would have had. But there again, that's making people suspicious. Okay, we have it. We're trying to sell a hoax. If we come up with a big codex, it's going to immediately draw suspicion. But if we come with something that looks like it's part of a personal collection, they're going to say, oh, this could have been discovered by accident. And so again, you just got to be careful. So kind of like what happened in the Middle Ages when they sold 16,000 tons of the cross of Jesus to pilgrims. So, yeah. And I forget how many thousands of water that was there. That's right, yeah. So, well, to this day, that's still the biggest problem with the Shroud of Turin. It dates to the same period, at least the dyes and the cloth and so forth, as to when all these artifacts were being sold. I forget how many thousands of gallons of water that were supposed to be in the cup that Jesus drank from that was also sold. So, yeah, there's certain eras where this kind of thing goes on. Hey, yes? Trying to disprove the Big Bang? Well, good luck.
Something about hydrogen and what was it? John?
Yeah, I don't remember the mechanistic details. I forwarded the article to him.
About,
he's 12 years old. He's in college. You know, higher IQ than Einstein. And he's trying, according to the article, I don't know the details behind it, so you got to be careful about news articles. As you, Rana, that he's trying to disprove, quote unquote, the Big Bang.
Well, it's something I got from these professors at Grove City and at the University of Pittsburgh, that the difference between a freshman and a senior, the freshman thinks he knows everything, the senior knows he doesn't know everything. So we'll see what happens as this young man matures. So, but Big Bang cosmology is on a very secure footing, as is the age of the Earth and the age of the universe. So that's not going to change, at least not by much of a percentage. Well, let's actually get into some of this content we've got here. I actually got to speak on this at both the University of Pittsburgh and Grove City College. Is a search for the existence of life in the universe. And what I found interesting about both the University of Pittsburgh and Grove City College is the biologists were not really aware that the origin of life community has basically given up on planet Earth as a site for the origin of life. And they weren't even aware of the oxygen ultraviolet paradox or the fact that there's no prebiotics on the face of the Earth. Now, I've been under the impression this is fairly common knowledge. And evidently it's not. I mean, here are professors of biology and chemistry at major institutions who are not aware of this. Now, it is true that the evidence is relatively new, but, you know, it's like 8-9 years old now. It's not that new. But as they told me, it's still in all the biology textbooks that there's this primordial soup on the Earth, lots of time, and out comes the origin of life. And it says, well, we now have overwhelming evidence that Earth never had prebiotics. We got both the isotope evidence and the physical proof that there couldn't have ever been prebiotics in the face of the Earth. And both groups of scientists were surprised that the origin of life community now agrees that indeed the lack of time and the lack of prebiotics, the lack of homochirals, eliminate Earth as a candidate for the origin of life under a naturalistic perspective. And hence, that's what's driving astrobiology. I actually had one professor say, what's going on with this astrobiology? Why do we need it? And I said, this is why we need it. Now, from a naturalistic perspective, Earth is not a candidate, so it's got to come from somewhere else. Yes?
I'm curious, what would you do if you were in a class now, let's say, the class was teaching this stuff about origin of life evolving on Earth, you know, with the primordial soup and all that stuff. Now, what would you do if you were given a test, you know, how did Earth originate? Would you say, okay, I don't believe that it originated, you know, on Earth in the way that you believe, you know, that you're teaching the principle? Or would you say, I know that this is the answer that you want, that there was the primordial soup, because that's what your book says, that there was the primordial soup and there was like a lightning bolt, that it's the primordial soup and this and that. How would you balance the fact that they want their answers from their books and you disagree?
Well, I actually faced that when I was being educated many years ago, because that was a standard textbook model. For some reason, my Canadian teachers and professors didn't push it. You know, they taught us that, but it wasn't on the test. They didn't push it. There seemed to be a recognition, okay, we have this data, but it's not undisputed. And so they left it alone. And one thing I did share with the Grove City College professors and students is, let's begin with the causality laws. The causality laws, which is something work across all different scientific disciplines, is that you cannot get something greater from that which is lesser. And so the created must always be lesser than the creator. And the problem we see with all three origins of life, origin of physical life that we're discussing, how can the non-living create the living? How can the simple create the complex? So you've got a problem with the causality laws right there, which should at least cause you to be hesitant to adopt, say, the Uri Miller story or the Sidney Fox story for the origin of life. And then when you get into the soulish animals, how does the non-personal produce the personal? I mean, your dogs and cats have a personality. Where did that come from? Is that going to come from physics and chemistry alone? And then you look at human beings. We are spiritual. How can the non-spiritual create the spiritual? And so, and then the whole history of life on planet Earth, where you go from simple to complex, small bodies to large bodies, again, that fundamentally violates the principles of causality. So right there, that should kind of give you a foundation. And I kind of did that because I realized a lot of the students I was talking to had no background or little background in science. So, you know, even if you don't know the science, you know this. In fact, one of the professors stood up and said, "Where did you get this from?" I said, "It's been around for a couple of thousand years. Augustine wrote about this in his books 1,500 years ago. This is not new material. And if you take a course from a philosopher, this is just standard philosophy, freshman philosophy." And I said, "Well, maybe all scientists need to take a freshman course in philosophy." And I said, "Well, that's actually not a bad idea." So, and maybe all philosophers need to take a course in science. But, yeah, go ahead.
I was reading where there's certain scientists that have revisited Miller's experiment. And they found out that there's a lot of prebiotics. RNA and stuff like amino acids had been created in this in his experiment. So
that's from an LA Times article.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm actually going to comment on that. Maybe you should just you had a quick question.
Yeah, a quick one. It would seem to me, you know, with the life showing up at 3.8 billion years ago, and the total lack of evidence for the primordial soup after 20 years. I know that the textbook writers know this. It's purposely being omitted. It's purposeful and deliberate attempt at deception. I'm implying motives to the writers of the textbook, and it's malicious, and that's my view of it.
Well, I'm not quite that hostile because, you know, when I talk to these biologists, they just don't know. And it's like they're not up on this stuff. They don't go to these conferences, and they're reading the wrong journals. I mean, I told them, look, there's a journal called Origin of Life in the Biosphere. It is a fairly obscure journal, but the whole focus of that journal is on these very issues. But a lot of biologists don't read that material.
Doctoral biologists that are at the top of their fields writing these textbooks can't figure that out?
Well,
a little stupid Ted here sitting here.
Okay.
You know, I've heard it from you, but...
The chemists typically know about this stuff. So when I talk to chemistry professors, they're aware of this stuff. But I'm finding when I talk to biologists and evolutionary biologists, they don't know. And, you know, you say, wow, but, you know, keep in mind, I mean, in fact, I was talking to this guy in the airplane. And he said, you know, the problem with my 50 scientists, they're all hyper-specialists. And I hire all these different scientists, and I'm trying to get them to talk to one another, but they don't talk to one another. And I says, well, kind of what we've done at Reasons to Believe is we've pulled scientists out of academia and their hyper-specialization, but we purposely hire scientists who have a track record of doing interdisciplinary work. And see, what we're trying to do is cross the disciplines. And he says, I sure wish I could get my scientists to do that. But I think that tends to be the norm in academia is hyper-specialization. I mean, I've told you before that when I was at Caltech, we would all, at lunchtime, go over to the Burger Continental, basically take over the place. In fact, the owners there would reserve tables for us because they knew we were coming. And we had a separate table for the ultraviolet astronomers, one for the radio astronomers, one for the X-ray astronomers, and the gamma ray astronomers, and the infrared astronomers. And if you sat at the wrong table, you could not follow the conversation. It was that technical. So, and that's... You know, when I was at Caltech, that was the way it is. You're typically putting in 14-hour days, focusing on extremely narrow discipline, and when you do get time to read the scientific literature, you only read the papers in your narrow discipline. In fact, when I get together with astronomers, professional astronomers, what I find out is I'm the only one in the group that actually reads all the abstracts in the Astrophysical Journal. The rest of them just read a few. Only those in their discipline. They skip all the others. And part of it is they simply don't have time. They don't have time to get into the literature to the degree that we do. But it's very difficult to have a cross-disciplinary perspective if you're that narrowly focused.
I have another little comment. I went to a Caltech open house, not last year, the year before, and I was talking about life on other planets, in particular Mars. And the fellow was talking about the chemistry and this and that. I said, well, did you ever consider... I gave him your explanation of it, that detritus from the early Earth formation blasted off and got to that farther reach, you know, a small percentage. And it was news to him. And I told him about, you know, reasons.org. Look this up. You know, he was very interested.
Mm-hmm.
And here was me informing some brilliant, you know, Caltech physicist and biologist of the possibility of Earth life ending up on Mars.
Well, they are.
And he liked it.
Yeah, they are really brilliant. They're really brilliant about one narrow discipline, typically. So.
Too much information around. You don't have time to
sum it
all.
Well, one of the things I did know is at Caltech is I would purposely sit at the wrong table and just figure out, you know, try to see if I could survive. So.
One journal that's disseminated to all the professors and everybody in that field that can keep up with it, you know, but they can always do it on the internet. I mean, you can find out anything.
There's too much, though. There's way too much. I mean, just trying to keep up with the Astrophysical Journal, it's 4,000 pages a month. So, and it's 8.5 by 11, small print, lots of equations, not too many words. So, and, you know, I'm trying to read 10 journals like that. So, I mean, it's a real challenge. And that's the whole problem. We live in an age of information explosion and overload. And so it's just really hard for people to come up, which is why I don't blame the biologists. They don't know about this stuff. But that's one of our reasons why we're trying to get this stuff published, get it into the lay hands. Because one of the things we're finding is, you know, our book Origins of Life does get into the hands of biologists, but typically through lay people. Lay people buy the book and they give it to their biology professor friend. So that's how they're finding out about this stuff. But yeah, I mean, at the University of Pittsburgh, I had these biologists saying, we want to hear about this stuff. They were not closed. They just hadn't heard about it. Anyway, let me get into this, because rather than talk about it, let's actually get into this whole thing about the amino acids and try to address this issue that got published in the LA Times. In weeks past, I've given you the evidence why Earth is not a candidate for the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective, and why that's also true of every planet in our solar system, although we're on record ever since 1988 as predicting the remains of life will be found in every solar system body if we look hard enough for it, because Earth is exporting its life all over the solar system. And so if we go to Mars, we're going to find the remains of Earth life on Mars. Not much, but you'll find some. If you go to the moon, you should find it easily. The moon has been calculated at 20,000 tons of Earth's soil for every 100 square kilometers. And each ton of Earth soil is 10 to the 17 bacteria in it. So it shouldn't be that difficult to find remains of life on the moon. And the nice thing about the moon is it's got a very tepid geology. And so if stuff gets on the surface of the moon, it's not disturbed. In fact, as I've mentioned here before, the only place that we have a good shot at finding the fossils of Earth's first life is on the surface of the moon. Impossible to find on the Earth because the geology of the Earth has destroyed it. But during the very window when we have the first life on planet Earth, it was being aggressively transported throughout the solar system. We can go to the moon and we can recover the fossils of Earth's first life. And that's crucial because the atheists predict something very different about what that first life should look like compared to what we would predict from a biblical perspective. And what I've told NASA when I was speaking in Houston, if we were to give that a priority for NASA to go to the moon and find the fossils of Earth's first life, you'll get 100% taxpayer support, because the U.S. taxpayer can be put into two categories, Christian and non-Christian, and both would have a vested interest in seeing this discovery being made and determining who's right and who's wrong, as opposed to going to Mars where you only got one slice of the taxpayer base behind you. Let's do something where you get all the taxpayers excited about it. Anyway, as we've been talking, we now know that in terms of the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective, the entire solar system has been eliminated, which is the excitement about interstellar clouds. Interstellar clouds are these dense molecular clouds that are being heated up and are forming new stars. And by the way, that's one of the requirements for life to exist, that it be in a galaxy where star formation is continuing. Only a galaxy with ongoing star formation can maintain the stability and the symmetry of its spiral arms, a fundamental requirement for advanced life. So we see here is the Orion Nebula, And it's one of the ones that have been most intensely studied. Also, the gaseous nebulae that are at the center of our galaxy. And in these nebulae, radio astronomers have discovered 123 distinct carbonaceous molecules. Some of them as complex as three carbon glycoaldehydes. That's about the most complex one that they've found. And so because they're finding so many of these carbonaceous molecules, this has caused Origin of Life researchers to say, this is the place where life originates, or at least the place where we get the proteins, the DNA, the RNA, and the membranes, and then it gets transported to the Earth. The problem is there's no ammonia. If you don't have ammonia, you really don't have an effective pathway to make the amino acids and the nucleotides. The other thing we notice is no sugars. Yeah, we do find some glycoaldehydes, but if you're going to put the nucleotides together, you have to have five carbon sugars. And there's no five carbon sugars. By the way, I can make a blanket statement. They have found five carbon sugars only in life and the decay products of life. No matter where we go in the universe, no matter where we go on the Earth, we find no natural source for the pentose sugars. And pentose sugars are essential to any Origin of Life model. So there again is a simple argument. If you can't find any natural source of pentose sugars, you don't have a naturalistic model for the Origin of Life. And we've looked, and we've been looking very intensely for many decades. No sugars, nowhere on the Earth or anywhere else in the universe. Neither are there any nucleobases or amino acids. Now, this is something, again, where the textbooks may not be up to date. Because if you read the textbooks, they'll make reference to astronomers discovering one of the nucleosides in one of these gas clouds. And also, they found glycine in one of these gas clouds. But a little more than a year ago, two papers were published in the Astrophysical Journal, basically saying, in both cases, misidentified spectral lines. So, as it now stands, we have yet to find a single amino acids or a single nucleotide and no sugars in any of these gas clouds. We're finding lots of complex stuff. But the crucial ingredients for the origin of life, these three, are completely missing. Now, when I say that, I'm not saying they'll continue to be completely missing. The very fact that we see 123 carbonaceous molecules in these gas clouds means there's got to be the chemistry present that's going to be producing these, at least a few of the nucleotides and a few of the amino acids. The problem is we don't have the sensitivity to detect them. We certainly know they're not at parts per million. That's been ruled out. But they could be there at, say, 2 or 3 parts per billion, because we don't have the sensitivity to get down that far. And I would almost guarantee that they have to be there at parts, say, 2, 3, or 4 parts per billion, just because of the existence of the other molecules. Those other molecules are going to guarantee there's production at that level. So, within a few years, someone's going to announce we found glycine or we found a nucleotide, but at a very low abundance level. And it's parts per billion. It's useless for any origin of life model. In fact, parts per million are useless, let alone parts per billion. And the other thing we notice is in these interstellar gas clouds, we don't see a source for homochirality. By the way, that was a big announcement just 2 days ago. In fact, I got it in my briefcase there. A paper just got published claiming that they discovered a homochiral source next to a neutron star. But if you read the paper, it says they found a 1.9% excess of left-handed compared to right-handed. For life chemistry to happen, you need 100%. So 52% to 48% isn't going to help you at all. But that's the best they've ever found in any astrophysical source. Moreover, they're finding it right next to a neutron star. Not unexpected, because neutron stars do pour out circularly polarized ultraviolet light. And cyclotron experiments done in up there in the Bay Area at Livermore Labs have shown that if you have circularly polarized ultraviolet light, you can get a minimal amount of excess of left compared to right or right compared to left. That can happen. Well, now we found a natural source that does that. However, It's not exactly the ideal location for origin of life chemistry, right next to a neutron star. Those neutron stars are pouring out such nasty radiation, it'll break up any molecules that ever get a chance to get started. But the very latest on this research is, yes, we're not finding these molecules in these interstellar clouds, but we are finding them in a few of the meteorites that we see in the face of the Earth, the Murchison meteorite, the biggest carbonaceous meteorite ever discovered on the Earth in Australia, does have amino acids at parts per million. And they've got a nucleobase base at a few parts per billion. But we're not finding that in the interstellar clouds at those abundance levels. And so a recent paper has been published. Again, it's in my briefcase there. I should have brought it out. But I was up late last night, so I wasn't really all together this morning. Kind of know what Ross feels like, so. But what the paper is indicating is that when a comet or a big rock or a big chunk of dust comes pouring through the atmosphere, as it goes through the atmosphere and as it collides with the Earth, the very act of colliding with the Earth produces a small amount of these amino acids. So when they come into the Earth's environment, they don't have these molecules. But when they come crashing through the Earth and hit the Earth, somehow it generates a chemical reaction that produces a few of the amino acids and one of the nucleobases. And so they're saying maybe this is the answer to the origin of life. But the paper goes on and says, we find only a few of the amino acids, and in particular, there's no chemistry that could possibly work on the face of the Earth or in the atmosphere of the Earth that can produce the basic amino acids. Let me see if I can remember this. Maybe I'm going to need some help here from Richard Deem. Arginine is one of the basic amino acids, and there's another one that's also got a long name that's a basic amino acid. But this is a brand new paper that's been published. In fact, I got an article up this on our website in today's New Reason to Believe. So you can check it out, and I got the citations to the literature in that article. But yeah, there's two of the 20 essential biological amino acids which this paper establishes cannot be produced by any natural mechanisms. And so what the paper was really looking at is, okay, given that these basic amino acids are missing, is it still possible to build an origin of life research model? And they discovered they could actually make proteins without these two amino acids. But they were small proteins, and they were proteins that could not interact with DNA or RNA. And the conclusion of the paper is, without these two crucial amino acids, there's no way we can get proteins communicating with DNA and RNA. If we can't do that, we don't have a naturalistic origin of life model. And that's kind of what was going on in that LA Times article. It's saying, yes, we are finding these amino acids. They're finding guanine, and they're finding, I think, four other amino acids. The other 15 are completely missing. So they don't have a full suite. But what is most exciting is this new paper that was published in the Astrophysical Journal that states that it's actually impossible to make these basic amino acids on any realistic conditions that ever existed on the surface of the Earth or in these gas clouds, saying that no matter how sensitive we get, we're never going to find those two crucial amino acids. Yes?
What would be the destruction rate, the half-life, if you will, of a nucleobase or a naturally occurring amino acid? How long is this thing going to stick around? A billion years? 15 seconds?
You know. It depends on the environment. It's temperature sensitive. The warmer the temperature, the faster they get destroyed. And the longer they stick around, And so, for example, what I was going to talk about next is what we saw happen at an Origin of Life research conference where they said, let's forget about all these problems about trying to get these materials in gas clouds or anywhere else. Let's just assume somehow it happens, and we don't know how it happens. And then they said, let's go to the next issue. If it does happen somewhere in the universe, can it actually get to the surface of the Earth? And so we've got dust or comets or rocks coming into the Earth. Is that a viable way of trying to get the ingredients of life? And it's kind of what you're bringing up, Ted. Well, one problem is, as you go through interstellar space, you're going to be exposed to X-rays and ultraviolet radiation. That's going to break down whatever amino acids or nucleotides or sugars that you might have. And then we're also looking at millions of years for these materials to go through interstellar space. And when you've got half-lives of hours, that's not going to help. And so bottom line is, by the time it gets to the Earth, it's going to be completely destroyed. And as it goes through the Earth's atmosphere, it's going to be heated up to 500 degrees centigrade plus. But this new research is showing, okay, these ingredients don't exist when they're in interstellar space because they get destroyed by the transport time, the radiation exposure, and they'll also get destroyed by going through the Earth's atmosphere. But once through the Earth's atmosphere, as they begin to approach the ground and hit the ground, there's some kind of chemistry that is able to produce these amino acids, which explains why meteorites that are on the ground have these amino acids, but we don't see them in outer space. So something is happening chemically. Now, the paper is suggesting chemical reactions that could take place on the Earth that would make this happen. But what's interesting, too, is some hint that it's life on the Earth which actually sets up the possibilities, chemical reactions. So the question they raised is, maybe you need life in order to even get these reactions to take place. So, but basically, the question is unanswered. But they do know something is happening when the meteorite hits the Earth that's generating these amino acids. So they're not in the meteorite. They're produced when they hit the ground. Now, that's part of the story. The other part of the story is contamination. There's amino acids all over the Earth, nucleotides all over the Earth. In fact, one paper I've got makes the point that when a meteorite goes through the Earth's atmosphere, it picks up amino acids and nucleotides as it goes through the atmosphere. And so there's contamination even when they go through the atmosphere, which caused one astronomer at the Origin of Life conference that Fuzz and I attended suggesting, what we need to do is catch one of these meteorites before it gets very deep into the Earth's atmosphere, and then we can tell what's going on. Of course, technologically, trying to actually catch one of these things is not a very easy job. I remember when I was growing up in Canada, there was a big research. In fact, we were part of it. They had all of us amateur astronomers watching the sky, watching these meteorites come down. Whenever we saw the fireball, we'd immediately report it to Ottawa, and they would actually send out helicopters and try to recover these things. And their goal was to recover a meteorite within minutes or hours after it landed. And the goal was to catch it before it got too badly contaminated by the remains of life here on Earth. In fact, the least contaminated meteorite was found in Tagish Lake in northern Canada. And it was amateurs that saw this meteorite coming down. The Canadian government actually got there right away. The lake was frozen, and so they could land the helicopter right in the lake. They could find the meteorite because it looked black compared to everything else, and they literally analyzed it within hours after it fell. But even then, they concluded that the Tagish Lake meteorite got contaminated within those few hours. And so that's another issue, trying to separate the contamination from what's really there. But this paper I'm referring to, I think, has done a good job in saying it can't all be contamination. There must be something that's happening chemically when the meteorite rock actually hits the Earth. Some chemical reaction is generating this. But bottom line is, this is not helping the origin of life problem at all, because all you're getting is a production of a few amino acids. This is not life coming from outer space. There's the stuff happening on the surface of the Earth. Yes?
If it were contaminated while coming through the atmosphere,
would it just fly? No, this is after you go through the hot part of the atmosphere, and then now you're coming down, and you know, if it crashes into snow, and the snow is deep. I mean, there's been a lot of efforts at that, too. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, people have fallen out of airplanes without a parachute and survived. It depends where you fall. If you fall on a nice steep slope with deep, soft snow on it, you've got a good chance of survival. If you fall in an L.A. parking lot, not such a good chance. So,
well, I mean, while it's still in the air, you said it could get contaminated while it's in the air?
While it's in the air, it can get contaminated.
By the time it hits the ground, it would already have been fried.
Well, when it hits the ground, there's a heat reaction, definitely. But what this paper is pointing out is if you get a big enough meteorite, like the Murchison meteorite is several tons. So it's a big meteorite. And so you get a lot of heating in, say, the outer meter of the meteorite. Yeah. But the inner part wouldn't experience that degree of heating. And so this is the next suggestion, is that, okay, it's not going to work to get dust or a comet coming through the atmosphere delivering life. Maybe something big like the Murchison meteorite, a big rock. Now, the problem is this. It won't do any good to transport a rock from Mars or one of the moons of Jupiter, because we already know that that's ruled out as a site for the origin of life. So now we've got to get the rock from some other planetary system. And so the suggestion here is there's some distant planet out there that's loaded with life, and it gets clobbered, and a big rock leaves that planet, goes through interstellar space, and lands on the Earth, and that explains the origin of life. Now, it does have to be a pretty big rock because of the heating problems and the exposure. I mean, if you're going through interstellar space, you're being exposed to ultraviolet radiation, X-rays, you're there for a long time. But one of the origin of life researchers says we can make it work if we got a rock that's 2 meters in diameter or bigger, that has no cracks in the rock and no holes in the rock, and we put a bacterium right at the dead center of that rock. And then it will be able to survive going through interstellar space and going through the Earth's atmosphere and landing on the surface of the Earth. And so Jay Malosh, an astronomer in Arizona, did a calculation where he said, let's assume that the Milky Way galaxy has more planets than it has stars. That's not likely. Let's just assume it has more planets than it has stars. And let's assume all of those planets have just as abundant life on it as Earth does. So, you know, kind of an extreme thought experiment. Okay? You know, hundreds of billions of planets, all of them loaded with as much life as the Earth, and all of them being bombarded frequently enough that you're going to get rocks exported from those planets whizzing through interstellar space. Then he calculated how frequently we would get a rock from one of those planets. And he said, well, you're not going to get a rock as big as 2 meters across. In fact, he calculated, we're talking a rock as big as a human fist. One arrives on the surface of the Earth every 10 to the 16 years. Okay, that's a million times older than the age of the universe. And therefore, that's not how life got here. Can I take a few more minutes? Okay, because I'm just going to give you the bottom line, then we can move on. Well, at the last Origin of Life Research Conference that Buzz and I was able to attend, and you say, why aren't you keeping up with this? Well, you know, we were at the last one. All these Origin of Life researchers got together and said, you know, our discipline isn't doing that well. When we have our meetings, let's at least have meetings in really nice places. Well, that's what they're doing. They're having their meetings in really exotic resort-type places overseas, and we just couldn't justify spending reasons to believe money to go there. So what we told them is, next time you guys have a conference in a place that's cheap and relatively local, we'll be there. But we're not going to spend, you know, $20,000 having a vacation with you guys, and we can just read your abstracts. But at the last conference we attended, a guy got up to the microphone, one of the scientists, and said, during the past 4.5 days, we ruled out planet Earth, we ruled out the solar system, we ruled out comets, we ruled out interstellar clouds, we ruled out dust transport, now we've ruled out rock transport. The only thing we have left is directed panspermia. Okay? That intelligent beings in spaceships came to planet Earth 3.83 billion years ago and put life here on planet Earth. And he went on to say, you know, this would also explain all the mass speciation events. Cambrian explosion, Avalon explosion, yeah, they came back and put life. They brought the dinosaurs here and all that kind of stuff. So they've been coming here frequently, and that explains the whole history of life on planet Earth. Well, that's the whole problem. Where do you get the aliens? And the really big problem is they have to exist 3.83 billion years ago. And it's, again, this guy wasn't an astronomer, But, you know, in astronomy, we've known for, 20 years now that advanced life is only possible when the universe is about 13.7 billion years old. This is way too early to have intelligent life. Intelligent life can't possibly exist that early. If you want to know why, you can get my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. A couple of chapters are lay out why it's impossible to have advanced life as early as, say, 10 billion years after the cosmic creation event. Then the other big problem is, how could they get here? If you pick up our book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, we explain why the laws of physics and the dimensions of the universe do not permit interstellar space travel. I don't care how much technology and wealth an intelligent civilization has, they can't buck the laws of physics. As we explain in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, interstellar space is not completely empty. It's loaded with electrons and protons and little bits and pieces of dust, and that's going to limit how fast you can move through interstellar space. In fact, we calculate at the very best you can go 1% the velocity of light. That's if you've got unlimited wealth and unlimited technology. You might be able to go that fast. But if you're going that fast, you're now exceeding the maximum lifespan of any technologically advanced civilization. Research shows that if we're talking civilization as technologically as advanced as we were at the end of World War II, the maximum longevity is about 2,000 years. There's good reasons why we cannot maintain our level of technology, probably not longer than 1,000 years, but 2,000 years would be the absolute limit before you'd have to collapse that technology down. And if you're looking at 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years to cross interstellar space, that actually exceeds the maximum longevity of an intelligent civilization, let alone trying to keep peace on board one of these things. I mean, experiments have been done where they put six people inside a small container for 6 months, and they do not survive psychologically. By the way, this proposal has been around in the Origin of Life research community ever since 1981. Francis Crick, Nobel laureate, wrote a book with Leslie Orgel back in 1981, whereas as Origin of Life researchers, they said, even back in 1981, we've eliminated everything except this possibility. This explains the origin of life here on planet Earth. But it really doesn't, because the origin of life happened so long ago. And this is why I really can't enjoy watching Star Trek on TV. It's like every 10 seconds they violate the laws of physics. So, and not just one or two, they violate a whole bunch.
It's science fiction.
Yeah, well, you know, to me, good science fiction violates the laws of physics maybe once a minute, not once every 10 seconds. Or you violate one law of physics, but when you violate 15, then it gets to lose credibility. So, well, my sons say, Dad, your problem is you know too much physics. But if you want to buy a fun book, it's written by an atheist, but Lawrence Krauss wrote a book called The Physics of Star Trek, where he documents the dozens of ways Star Trek violates the laws of physics and why you can't beam people up and why you can't go across interstellar space. And this, by the way, is now a consensus of the scientific community. We human beings will never be able to visit planets on other stars. We are stuck here on planet Earth. In fact, I've been involved in debates with atheists where they actually use that as a proof that God is not an all-powerful, all-loving being. So the very fact that the physics of the universe constrains us to our solar system means that God doesn't love us. He's only allowing us to visit this little tiny realm around here, and therefore a loving God can't exist. There's an easy rebuttal to that. The new creation, we are promised a limitless habitat space. We're only constrained to a small habitat space now. God is promising us a much bigger habitat space after he conquers the problem of evil that was introduced in the Garden of Eden. The reason why we got such a small habitat space, that's all that humanity can tolerate now. We have to be in a playpen. We're too immature to be allowed out of our playpen of the solar system. But a time will come when we'll gain the maturity. Okay, what's left? You know, Fuzz and I actually had our mouths drop when we heard this guy get to the microphone and seriously propose directed panspermia. But then I kind of elbowed Fuzz there and said, you know what? He's on the right track. He's right. It's an intelligent alien up from outside that brought life to planet Earth. It's not an alien from another planet. It's a being from beyond the universe. That's what brought life here to planet Earth. Well, this isn't quite the end of the story. The Santa Fe Institute, for decades now, has been saying that the only solution to the origin of life, they're aware of all this, and they have been for some time, and they're an interdisciplinary group, so they're able to cross the disciplines. But their answer is, there's a fourth law of thermodynamics. You've heard about the three laws of thermodynamics. Well, you got Stuart Kaufman for years now has been proposing a fourth law of thermodynamics. His whole motivation as an atheist for promoting this fourth law of thermodynamics, he says, is the only way to solve the origin of life problem. That there's this hidden law of physics that spontaneously takes simple systems and transforms them into complex systems. He gave a lecture on this at Caltech many years ago. And the first part of his lecture, he showed why all the other naturalistic explanations for the origin of life are impossible and said this is the only thing left. But he also admitted in that lecture that we have zero observational evidence or experimental evidence that such a law exists. Well, actually, he was too conservative. We actually can rule out such a hidden law because one of the requirements for life to even exist in the universe is the universe has to be extremely uniform and homogeneous. And if it's extremely uniform and homogeneous, that means there's no possibility that such a law could be hidden from view. Because basically what Stuart Kaufman was saying is there's exotic places in the universe where things aren't like we see everywhere else. There's exotic places where the second law is not the rule of the land, rather the fourth law is. And we just haven't found those sites yet, but that's where the origin of life takes place, and somehow it got transported to the Earth. However, the very fact that life requires a universe that's extremely uniform and homogeneous means there can't be exotic sites where such a hidden law exists. If such a hidden law existed, astronomers would have seen it years ago. But actually, if such a hidden law exists, there wouldn't be astronomers. Life would be impossible. So what's really left? What's really left is what we see in Genesis 1-2. The Spirit of God was hovering over the waters of planet Earth. That's the origin of life, according to the Bible. The Spirit of God was brooding over the surface of the waters and brought life to the surface of the waters 3.83 billion years ago. Anyway, you can read all about it in Origins of Life. And by the way, we've just gotten a good endorsement of this book from one of the leading atheist Origin of Life researchers. He actually wrote a review in the journal Origins of Life and the Biosphere. So he got it published in a peer-reviewed journal. And I can tell you bottom line what he said about our book. He said this is the best book giving an overview of the current science of the Origin of Life research area. And he likes everything about the book except the Jesus Christ part. That part, he said, he didn't go along with. He says they didn't convince me that there had to be Jesus Christ here, but they did convince me that this is the best and most faithful scientific status report on the origins of life. So we took that as a positive review. And by the way, we know what he told us privately over the phone. He says, I've got children. And for the sake of my children, I hope you guys are right and I'm wrong. So he says, I don't want you to publish that. So next week, we'll talk about the origin of spiritual life. Sorry about taking the extra time, but I just thought we need to make some progress in this class. Some of you have been complaining how slow we've been moving. So. And this Wednesday, I will be talking on the creation accounts, and it'll be like one of my standard lectures. I'm going to speak for an hour without any interruptions. Then we'll have Q&A as long as you like. So we'll do that. If you want to see the other style of my lecturing, then you can come Wednesday. Thanks.